This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. I'd like to begin by reading to you from the Evening News of India, Tuesday, October 12, some years ago. All 89 passengers and 6 crew members were killed when an Indian Airlines plane bound for Madras crashed within minutes of takeoff at Santa Cruz Airport at 1:40 a.m. today. The plane was only some 3 minutes airborne when its pilot noticed a fire in one of the engines. He was reported to have told air traffic control of the fire and said, "I'm coming back." Eyewitnesses, including friends and relatives who had come to see the passengers off, saw the plane burning in the night sky like a red ball before it crashed. The passengers had no chance. I remember Tuesday, October 12, very well, with crystal clarity. I was sitting in the TV room with my brothers watching TV when the phone rang. Mum took the call and received the news that she'd been dreading since she'd heard the midday bulletin on the radio. The news that my father was on the plane. The days following the accident are admittedly a blur, but my mum tells me I went up to her a few days afterwards and said, "Why did God let Dad's plane crash?" Now you need to understand, ours was not a religious home. I had never been to church, never been to Sunday school. We never discussed religion in the home. And yet somehow this 9-year-old unreligious boy had a hunch there was meant to be a God in charge of the world, and that on this occasion he had mucked things right up. Now, I share this with you not to gain your sympathy at the beginning of a series on suffering, nor even to establish my right to speak on this difficult subject. Frankly, apart from this one event in my life, I think I've had a pretty blessed, trouble-free existence. I share this with you to illustrate the universality of the question, why God? Even an unreligious 9-year-old boy has a hunch that that's the question you ask when faced with terrible pain. It's a question that is shared by many thousands every single day. Every time a marriage fails or a business goes bust or a child dies of cancer, the question goes up, why God? I want to concede right up front in this series the undeniable force of this question. Despite the confidence I will no doubt exude in the Christian response to suffering over this series, don't be fooled. I am not untroubled by this question. Indeed, there are still moments, honestly, when I quietly and sometimes not quietly say, God, why? To be honest, I'm not sure the Bible answers all of my questions on the topic of suffering, let alone yours. However, I do think the Bible offers the least incomplete response to the question of suffering. I hold to the biblical perspective, not because it has some knockdown argument about the question of suffering, but because I sincerely believe it is the only perspective in the world that is not itself completely knocked out by the force of this terrible question. That's why in this first talk at the front of the series, I want to devote some time to unpacking the alternatives, the alternative perspectives on suffering that are on offer today. Now, my intention here is not to disprove the alternatives, nor even to critique them. I simply want to unpack them so as to illustrate the difference, and I think beauty, of the Christian or biblical response to the question of pain. So let me begin with Hinduism. Hinduism has a clear and comprehensive response to the question of suffering. Within Hinduism, you may already know, all events in the universe are sincerely regarded to be the result of karma, the divine principle of balance in the universe, the principle that matches your deeds with outcomes, whether the deeds of this life or a prior life. You reap the consequences in this life. For example, a Hindu family who loses a baby sincerely believes that it is reaping the consequences of its actions, either from this life or a prior life. Again, a Hindu businessman who sees a leper begging by the road, however much he may feel compassion toward that person, sees someone who is reaping the consequences of his or her karma. Suffering within Hinduism is rationalized not as an inversion of the Creator's intentions for the universe, but as a divinely sanctioned balance. Secondly, like no other religion on the planet, Buddhism arose as a direct response to the problem of pain. I'm not sure if you knew that, but Buddhism is all about suffering. Siddhartha Gautama, you may know, was an Indian prince around 500 BC who had lived a life of luxury and comfort until he was about 29. And he ventured outside the palace walls and over a three-day period was confronted with untold suffering. He returned to the palace and determined that day, whatever it took, to discover the solution to the problem of suffering. He left his wife and his newborn baby and spent the next 7 years in ascetic denial, rigorous treatment of the body, and eventually meditation for hours on end until he discerned the answer to the question. He received his enlightenment after 7 years and was henceforth known as the Buddha, the Enlightened One. Siddhartha Gautama came to believe that suffering is an illusion through which you must learn to see. It's difficult, but let me explain what he taught. The second noble truth of Buddhism, and there are four, states suffering arises from desire. Suffering arises from desire. His explanation is brilliant. I'll give you a couple of examples. The pain of losing a father, so would say Siddhartha, arises not because of the loss of the father as such, but because of the child's desire for a father's affection. Think about it. It's brilliant. The suffering felt by a beggar arises not so much from the circumstances of poverty as much as from the beggar's desire for a better life. If a child can remove his desire for a father's love, then the experience of loss will not be felt as suffering. If a beggar can remove his or her desire for a better life, the experience of poverty will evaporate, no longer causing suffering. In fact, the third noble truth simply says that the extinguishment of suffering is the removal of desire. The fourth noble truth is follow the Buddha's eightfold path and you will extinguish desire. The whole of Buddhism is about this question. Well, quite different from Buddhism is the response to suffering found in the world's second largest religion, Islam. Within Islam, all events are thought of as determined by the will of God, The finger of Allah, says the Muslim. Every time a war breaks out, or a baby dies, or a plane falls from the sky, it is the finger of Allah. In this way, Islam understands God as the unmoved mover. A famous phrase first coined by the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle. But it's a viewpoint that is exemplified in the Islamic theology of the Middle Ages, particularly in the majority Sunni tradition of Islam, where they teach that God moves all things in the universe, but is himself moved or affected by nothing. He is the unmoved mover. The reason an event is so moved or determined by Allah is for Muslims unknowable and unquestionable. Which may sound harsh to modern Western ears, but a Muslim would instantly respond by saying that it is precisely in you absolutely resigning yourself to the will of God that your meaning as a human being is found. The word Islam, in fact, means submission. The word Muslim means one who submits to the will of Allah. Well, different from all of these, what you call religious responses, is the response of the atheist, the one who rejects the existence of God completely. For an atheist, of course, suffering is not the result of karma or desire or the finger of God or anything like that, but just from the sheer natural forces of the world. For the atheist, there is no design, no purpose, no grand unfolding story in human history. There is just the random intersection of time and space. And the intersection of those things sometimes turns out well and sometimes it doesn't. It's just natural, no purpose. Perhaps the most famous exponent of this perspective is the Oxford zoologist Richard Dawkins, and I think I may have quoted him before, but he has a wonderful way with words. In a universe of blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, other people are going to get lucky, and we won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect. If there is, at the bottom, no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. DNA just is, and we dance to its music. Love to have been there when he penned that paragraph. I'm sure he patted himself on the back. Fortunately for the human race, atheism has never really caught on. Even in a country as secular and post-Christian as our own, atheism accounts for only 6% of the population. It's only about 4% worldwide. Nevertheless, for this segment of society, the question, why God, is completely overruled, isn't it? There is no question to ask for the simple reason that there is no one to ask. But within the biblical perspective on suffering, the question is not sidelined or silenced. It is in fact invited. And let me repeat that I don't think the Bible answers all my questions, honestly. There are times, as I said before, when I still find myself asking why. But actually, this is one of the beautiful things about the biblical response to the question of suffering. The Bible does not insist on my resignation to the reality of suffering. It in fact issues to me and to you an invitation to come and ask the question, to approach God with our doubts and pleas. The Bible fully endorses your right to doubt, to complain, and to ask the question. Consider the text that was read to us just a moment ago. Psalm 22, famous psalm written centuries before Jesus. A person who had experienced, from the sounds of it, incredible social and physical pain. opens his psalm by saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. If I were a Buddhist, this line of questioning would be a sure sign of my lack of enlightenment. If I were a Muslim, these words would border on blasphemy. If I were an atheist, of course, it's a meaningless question. In fact, I suspect that many church folk, even sitting in this building tonight, would feel uncomfortable uttering those sentiments in prayer to God. I'm sure I'm right. Many religious people feel that the only faithful response to the experience of pain is the sentiment of the psalm that follows Psalm 22, the famous Psalm 23 with its, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not be in want. He makes me lie down in green pastures." And some people think they need to utter that as a mantra, even if it doesn't correspond to reality. But the presence of Psalm 22 before Psalm 23 stands as a reminder that sometimes the plea, "My God, why have you forsaken me," is just as much an expression of faith as the affirmation, "The Lord is my shepherd." In fact, I suppose one leads to the other. This same point was put well in an essay on the Psalms by the lead singer of U2, someone I rarely quote, Bono. He describes the Psalms as the original blues music. "That's what a lot of the Psalms feel like to me," says Bono, "the blues. Man shouting at God, 'My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?'" He quotes Psalm 22. Now, at one level, Bono's statement needs qualifying. At another level, I don't think it goes far enough. I'd want to qualify his statement by suggesting that there is such a thing as an inappropriate questioning of God. Like the embarrassing first-year philosophy student who smugly puts up his hand to ask the professor a question he thinks the professor's never heard before. There is a questioning of God that's born of arrogance and ignorance. Like the Chardonnay complaint we've probably all heard, "Oh, there's too much suffering in the world for me to believe in God." The reality is, philosophers long ago pointed out that the presence of pain in the world could never be used as evidence against God's existence until we could first prove that God has no valid reason for allowing it to continue. While I'd qualify Bono's comments by suggesting that we bring our questions to God in humility rather than arrogance and ignorance, there's a very real sense in which Bono doesn't go far enough for my liking. Psalm 22 is far more than simply man shouting at God. It is God's invitation for you to do so. By including this psalm and many like it, the Bible takes an approach to suffering quite unlike those approaches of the religions of the world. Our doubts and fears and complaints and questions are allowed, as long as it's not born of arrogance. You're invited to approach the Almighty with your complaints. And if any other proof of this point were needed, let me point out that at the moment of his greatest need, on the cross, Jesus himself reached for the very words of Psalm 22 to express what he was feeling. Mark 15:34 says that at the ninth hour on the cross, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, quote, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Psalm 22. The God of the Bible bids you to approach him with your questions and doubts and fears and frustrations. For it is precisely in this mode of personal engagement with God, man shouting at God, to use Bono's phrase, that God is able to whisper back his rather unexpected replies. The content of those replies will be the subject of my next two talks. But tonight I simply want to say, whether you have suffered or not, if this is a question you have pondered, please don't shout it from the sidelines. Approach God himself in prayer and you ask him. You say, God, why? Because it's in that mode of personal engagement that he will whisper back his reply.